Good afternoon. Hi. All good? Thank you for being here. I know it's a bit hard this session for a couple of reasons. I know some of you attended the 410 and the 411 already, just by show of hands. Most of you, good. Who has never done any Microsoft Exam before? You all have. Okay, that's already good. Second reason why it's a bit tough, it's this session and then directly drinks. So I hope you're going to stay until the end. I have some giveaways, so if that's not the main reason for being here, right. So this session, I'm going to talk about the exam prep helping you in passing. That's my main goal, giving you some tips and tricks on how to take the exam with confidence. So not just by, yeah, you know, it's 50% discount, I'm just going to take the exam, and if it's not working out, it's not working out. I mean, that's not what I want to give you. My idea is you walk out of this session, tomorrow morning, you book your slot, you take the exam, and you pass. That's my goal. For the 412 and the 417, the main difference is the 412 is for the ones who are not MCSA yet, and they are taking the 10, 11, and 12 as separate exams. The 417 is an upgrade if you are an MCSA on 2008 already. So who's already MCSA on 2008? Good. A couple of words about myself, so you at least know who this stupid fellow is in front of the room. I've been working with Microsoft technology since, I could say since I was born, but that was maybe a bit too soon. I started with MS-DOS 4.6 when I was like 8, 9 years old. When my father's PC was his business machine, way expensive at that time. It was even in Belgian francs, so that's even more expensive. And I was started playing with MS-DOS, and then moved all the way up to Windows, and then Windows 1, Windows 2, Windows 3, and 4, and then when my professional life started. So my 17 years experience is like my professional thing. What I do for a living is a mix between training and consulting. So I'm a Microsoft certified trainer for a couple of years already. But mainly doing a healthy mix between having the hands-on experience and evangelizing people, getting them aware like, hey, this is a cool technology. It's not only about learning, it's about getting a certification. We've got a couple of words and my own feedback why anyone should consider being certified. So I'm going to give you a couple of words on that one as well. Besides doing consulting and training, I'm also an author. I discovered this afternoon that there's one of my books in the store. I'm going to make a little competition. If you find it, make sure that you find me here. I will be around the certification hall the rest of the week. So buy my book if you find it, and then come over here, and I'll sign it for you. And next to that, again, my passion being a trainer, speaking in front of people like you who are interested in taking exams. I co-founded MCT Community. It's a worldwide organization, and I'm the Belgian leader and the European leader of that organization. So it's a passion for me. I think that's already quite clear. I like interaction even for the last session of the day. Send me a message on Twitter, send me an email. I promise you I will respond. And of course, if you have any questions, just raise your hand. We got a few helpers here as well, so we'll make sure that if I'm just looking that way of the room and your question is in that side of the room, we'll make sure that your question got answered. So the main objectives of this session is, first of all, giving you two key takeaways. Making sure that you know, what do I need to know for passing the exam? That's the main purpose of the session. So for the ones who are thinking that, hey, I'm going to attend the exam prep, and they give me a list of the 100 questions of the exam, that's not the purpose of the session. The main thing is, after the next hour or so, if you walk out of this room like, I know everything the guy was already talking about, I'll take the exam, and you got confidence, you will pass the exam. If, however, you walk out of the room like, yeah, there were still a couple of things, I have no idea it was part of Server 2012, then you're not ready yet to take the exam. But it's all about confidence. Does it mean you cannot pass the exam this week? Of course you can. We have a few options here during Tagat that will help you making sure that by the end of the week, Thursday evening before the party, you have your certification. And even if you want the 410, 411, 412 as well. Believe in it. That's the main thing. You have to believe in it. That's why you're here. So the objective is, first of all, describing what is Windows Server 2012 and what do I need to know for that specific exam, the 412. Now, another tip I can give to the guys and girls who are doing the 410 and 411, it's all about Server 2012. So it's not about, yeah, I'm going to take one exam and then I need another few months to study again. My advice when I'm doing training in classroom, my advice to my students is take all three exams a short period of time. You have to study for it, and the content, there's always some kind of overlap. In the 412, like if we're talking about DNS or dynamic access control, I'm going to explain all these topics in the next couple of minutes. Yeah, Active Directory is there, networking services is there, and that's a bit of content from the 410 and the 411 as well. So it might just help you. And even if you fail the first pick of the exam, I mean, I started my exams in, I think, 99-something, my first exams, NT4. In the meantime, I took quite a lot of them. And did I fail them? Yeah, I did. Was I proud about it? No, not really. But it happens. I mean, why do you fail an exam? Or you don't know the content, or you didn't prepare well, or you didn't have time to prepare. I mean, you get a lot of excuses there for failing an exam. Is it bad? Yeah, because you have to walk over to your boss saying like, hey, you paid $150 for my exam and I failed. And then he's like, oh, okay. You failed, so that's not good. And you cost me money on top of that. And you were not billable for 4 hours while you were sitting down in the test center, right? Another key takeaway is becoming familiar with the way how Microsoft exams questions are. It's not like, and I asked the question already before, who has been taken exams? The key thing is the way Microsoft is doing the exams is way different than before. And before, I'm talking about the last 2 years. The main thing is you need to know the technology. I know from the training center I used to work for, I'm talking like 10 years ago, they had like a marketing trick. You take the course, 5-day course, and Friday afternoon you take the exam, and we guarantee you pass. I can tell you it doesn't work like that anymore. If you don't know the technology, and by knowing I mean really having the hands-on experience, I couldn't say 100% guarantee you will fail, but I think it's pretty close to like 85. That's very important. Target audience, anyone, I could say anyone who is willing to take the exam, who is willing to make maybe a change in his job, making sure that he can pass the exam. The official explanation, I'm not going to read it out loud, might be a bit stupid. The key thing is, if you're passionate about Windows Server, if you're passionate about the technology, you want to show to your colleagues, to your boss, like, hey, I'm the guy, I'm the Windows Server guy in my organization, then this session is for you. And again, upgrade once or the new one, so the 410, 11, or the 417, if you were MCSA 2008 already. So with that, I'm going to hand over a couple of words to my colleague David, who's going to give you some sound testing. He's going to give you some tips and tricks on the changes I was talking about in the Microsoft certification space.
I saw quite a few people raise their hand before saying they've been here before for exam 410 and 11 exam prep, so I promise I will not bore you with repeating the same information. That is my pledge to you. Those of you know, and there won't be any clapping or the snaps as before either. So I'm just going to give you some new information, and for those of you that were not here before, I'm going to go quickly over some of the other stuff. So, because I want Peter to really get to the gist of the technical information, what is covered in this exam. Quickly, in terms of the resources we have here, these exam prep sessions are available from the schedule builders. You guys built them. There's lots of exam prep sessions over the next 4 days. They are really separated by day of technology. So today's Windows Server or Server MCSA, tomorrow is the UM day. So we've got SharePoint, Exchange, Link. We're covering all of those stuff, okay? We've also got private cloud tomorrow. Then after that, on Wednesday, we've got some developer stuff for the friendly developer people. And we've also got the a repeat of this of the 4:10 session. So if you missed the 4:10 session earlier today, there's a repeat of that. We've got 4:13, 4:14, 4:15, 4:16, which is the MCSE on Windows Server 2012 as well. So some of the topics here you find really interesting, Windows Server 2012, you want to go a little bit deeper, those are going to be on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, we've got SQL. I don't know how to spell that. I think it's three letters, but I'm not sure. So in terms of the changes, I'm going to talk about some other stuff that I didn't talk about earlier today. I talked to you guys in terms of recertification, the rigor, the increased rigor, how much more difficult the questions are today. And that, I mentioned also earlier today, it has to do with the content and the types of questions. And that's very important for you to realize. The content itself of these exams is really targeting your experience, how much experience you have working with the product. But a lot of people ask me, well, how much experience do I really need to have, and where am I getting that hands-on experience? Well, in terms of the target audience, what Peter was talking about before, there's also something else with the target audience, which is how many years of experience. So we're expecting 1 to 3 years experience working with the product. You're going to tell me, well, Windows Server 2012 has not existed for 3 years, right? And you'd be absolutely right. But we're talking about any version of Windows Server. So if you've been working with Windows Server since Windows 2000, you fall definitely beyond that bracket. Then, in terms of specific Windows Server 2012 experience, it's anything over 6 months. So for the MCSA, it's anything over 6 months of Windows Server 2012 experience, but we're looking for somebody who's got 1 to 3 years experience with Windows Server altogether. All right? When it goes to the MCSE level, certification goes a little bit deeper than that. So remember that the practice test is probably one of the best ways to figure out whether or not you're ready in terms of the depth of the questions. And an exam prep session like this, with the stuff Peter will tell you about, is really the technologies that you need to have deep, deep knowledge of in order to pass the exam. I mentioned earlier about the new certification, the MCSE coming back. The MCSE was gone for a while. We have the MCITP and the other certifications that were available for Microsoft Learning over the last few years. Some people are coming to us and tell me, well, you know what? I passed my exam on Windows Server 2008. I've got one or two exams that I've done. I'm missing another couple of Windows Server 2008 exams to get my MCITP certification. Can I still get those, or are those certifications still available? And they are. Even though the MCSE and the MCSA are back in terms of certification levels for Microsoft Learning, you still can become an MCITP, IT professional. So those certifications on Windows Server 2008, if you started those, you can finish them. The exams are available and the certification is still available. All right? In terms of the item types, I talked to you guys about some of the item types. I didn't talk about all of them. There's a cool new item type also that we have. These are called graphic interpretation questions. A graphic interpretation question is a question where you'll get a big graphic or maybe multiple graphics, and then we'll ask you to interpret those. We'll give you some statements. Maybe we'll show you a graphic of a configuration of a VPN, or we'll give you a configuration of RAS, and then based on that configuration, we'll give you statements of, you know, which protocol is being used for encapsulation. And then you'll have a drop-down list of protocols. And that's how you'll answer the question. So we won't necessarily have a specific question. We'll ask you to interpret a graphic. So you can expect to see questions like these as well. Also, we'll ask you some questions where there'll be a bunch of statements, and you'll have to tell us whether these statements are true or false. All right? So there's different questions that if you've taken certification exams in the last few years, you may have never encountered these types of questions because they've been newly introduced into Microsoft exams. I mentioned a little bit earlier that there's different variations or different forms of an exam, and that's true. If you're sitting next to someone, they'll be taking a version of the exam, you may be taking a completely different version of that exam. There's lots of exam questions out there that are in the ecosystem of certification testing centers, and the reason for that is that we're trying to fight piracy. We're trying to make sure that there's always new questions, and that's changing. So if you happen to see pirated questions out on the internet, it's very possible we've identified that those questions have been pirated, and we've removed them from the pool, and we've added new questions in. So these are constantly being updated, and there's teams of people that are working specifically on that to ensure the true relevance of the exam, and that somebody can't just walk in after having read questions on the internet and just pass the exam. If you're qualified, we want you to pass, but if you're not qualified, we definitely want you to fail as well. So I mentioned most of this already, so most of you guys have seen that. There's nothing new. Key takeaway here is the pass is 700. It means different things in different exams, all right? Exam scoring, remember that every question is worth an equal amount. What that means is that if you've got a question that's really, really long in one exam and another question that's really, really short and you've only got 5 minutes left, both questions are worth the same amount of points, okay? So don't kind of manage your time that way. I'm not going to tell you to answer one versus answer the other. Just remember that the questions are all equal within the same exam, all right? And I touched on this a few times, but sometimes it's something that people don't always get, so I'm going to go through it again because this is probably the thing that's going to help you the most take away the key information from a question, is the anatomy of an exam question. When we say an item, we mean an exam question. So every question is built the same way, all has the same formula. It starts off with a business problem, which is information about your environment, and then an overarching problem. You plan to deploy Windows Server 2012 remote access solution on your network. You have 5 servers that run Windows Server 2012. They are running the standard edition. And then you have a goal. It always starts with the 3 words, you need to. You need to install remote routing and remote access services on server named Server 1. Always starts with those 3 words. That specific you need to statement maps directly into your answer. So if you were reading just 2 sentences, you need to, and then the answer, they need to belong together. Everything else in the question is supporting information. Everything else is to help you ensure that that correct answer is the true correct answer, and the wrong answers are 100% wrong. And this is something that we ensure always gets true whenever we create exam questions. Right is 100% right, and wrong is 100% wrong. Okay? It's not kind of right or kind of wrong. They're absolutely definitives. That's what we work with in exam questions. You've got your correct answer. Sometimes it's 1 correct answer. Sometimes it's 2. Sometimes it's 3. Okay? There's some exams out there that do choose all that apply. Not that many, but there are some. And then you've got your wrong answers. Remember, questions are not designed to be tricky. We don't all want to trick anyone. If you're qualified, we want you to pass. If we try to trick you, then typically we're going to trick out people who are qualified and they're going to fail. And if you're qualified and you fail, then I have failed. All right? Any questions on certification related, specific questions, exam stuff? Perfect. So I'm going to pass it back to Peter, who's going to talk to us about all that delicious Windows Server 2012 stuff.
Thank you, David. So the main question for the next 50 minutes. Want to be in the pilot seat? To the beach, probably. And forget about the 412? No. We're going to dive into the technology. So the main objectives of the exam is actually, what do I need to know from a technical perspective? So the key topics, if you go onto the Microsoft website, and for the ones who don't know where to find the information, if there's time left, I can do a small demo. I know it's not really a technical session, but on that level, I mean. But I can show you where to find the exact information. So a couple of objectives. The first one is high availability. And again, think about where you are in the 2012 server roadmap. And again, I'm talking about 2012, but it's a mix between 12 and R2. So whenever I'm talking about 2012, 2012, R2, whatever, it's probably a mix. So one of the things that has been changed the last few months is training material is updated the last 2 months on the R2 version. Now you will see by, for example, this book, and one of you will have the chance to win the book, it still says 2012 R2. But on your exam, it might be possible that somewhere in your scenario, one of the questions that David was referring to, that they explicitly mention you have a server 2012. Is that important? Why yes and no? Just consider everything that's valid in the questions on 2012 is valid on R2 as well. If not, it's explicitly mentioned. So maybe one of the features that is really, really new in R2 that didn't exist in 2012, then of course in the question they will clearly mention it's an R2 environment. But to make my life a bit easier, I'm just going to mention 2012. So the first thing, very important, is high availability. Talking about clustering, talking about virtual environments, talking about cluster shared volumes, things like that. Second one is storage. Live migration, storage migration, CSVs, that's the topics I'm going to talk about. Next to that is business continuity, disaster recovery, backup solutions, and even talking a bit about maybe online backup. Does that mean you have to be the expert on Windows Azure already? Not at all. But as you might know out of your own experience, Server 2012, the native Windows backup solution, is already pre-built for having Windows online backup availabilities. So you might get out and get a free subscription to Azure for just trying some things out. So that's covered in the business continuity and disaster recovery. Next to that, network services. That's, I could say, the easiest one up to a certain point for the ones who were doing the 10 and 11 as well, because that's the main topic of the 4.10 and 4.11 is networking services. DNS, DHCP, but there's something new, which is part of the 4.12. Gonna talk about that later on. Active Directory, there it is again. So think about my advice, the 10, 11, and 12, take them all at about the same time, because a lot of content is already the same in the three exams. And then the last one, identity and access, it's about Active Directory, Active Directory Federation, very important feature in 2012. So that's the main topic. Now you can think like, yeah, I'm a smart guy, six topics, 20%, that's like 120%, right? Well, it's a mix. Does it mean you got, I don't know, 10 questions on each topic? Not at all. Some of them might be easy questions, and easy, I mean a short question. Some of them might be the long scenarios where David was already talking about. But in total, you have to know everything about the technology. You might guess a bit like, yeah, you know, I already am an expert on Active Directory. I'm already an expert on DNS, DHCP, so I can skip those things. Might not be the best solution for passing the exam. So you have to know it in and out. I'm going to say that a couple of times again. The main change between the 10 and 11, in the 4.12, it's why should I do this or why should I do that? So it's not only about installing the product, but it's about why should I create that specific kind of cluster solution? Why should I choose between doing a live migration or a quick migration, for example? So it's not only about this is the technology and you can use it for this and this and this, but it's what is the best solution for that specific scenario? So it's making it a bit more complex. When I'm doing training, I always talk to my students telling them like, the 4.10 is the intro level in the server technology. How to install the product, how to configure the, I could call it the baseline. The 4.11 is a bit more on networking service, main topic. And the 4.12 is all advanced features of the server product. So it's building up. Again, if you have a question, just let me know. So the first topic, high availability, configuring and managing. Four main topics, network load balancing, failover clustering roles, and managing your virtual environments. And specifically talking about how to move the VMs between machines, between platforms, even if you want. Very important, again, just by a quick look in the slide, and again, I'm not going to read out all the examples we have. One of the things you will find out is, what's the main thing on the slide? PowerShell. If there's anything you want to learn about the server product, it's PowerShell. All the examples I will give you, the main topics I'm going to walk you through, it's all referring to PowerShell. Does that mean the exam is PowerShell only? Not at all. But as you can imagine, PowerShell is a quite important aspect. Does it mean you have to be like the PowerShell guru? Again, not at all. Does it mean you have to think and learn about all the PowerShell commandlets? It's good that you know them, but it's even better that you get familiar with them. That's, again, the hands-on experience you need. I don't think anyone can remember, like, can you give me the full PowerShell line for installing, like in the example, installing the network load balancing feature? I have to be honest, even I don't know it by heart. But I know how to play with PowerShell, and I know my commandlets, and I know how to recognize the settings. That's the main important thing. So on the exam, it's not like they are giving you a blank PowerShell window where you have to start typing in the PowerShell commandlets yourself, but they might give you 3, 4, maybe 7 different lines of PowerShell code where they tell you, like, hey, can you pinpoint me the exact configuration? Why should I do this in that particular way? A couple of things important for your exam on network load balancing is, first of all, how to install the feature. So it's install Windows feature, or maybe by using the GUI as well. Of course, if you're running on the server core, you don't have the GUI, and that's why, again, PowerShell is quite important. Second thing is, if you have an NLB cluster, so you set up your first server, configure it as an NLB host, and then you need to add the second server to the cluster. So we're talking about clustering, but again, it's network load balancing. You're all familiar with network load balancing? Good. If not, just let me know. Then the last thing is configuring your client affinity. So that's how does my client connection, so my PC, for example, when I'm connecting to a web server who's running on NLB, how does it make the connection? 3 different options: no client affinity, single client affinity, and networking client affinity. So very important, the difference between the 3 options. They will never ask you what's the main difference between the 3, but again, scenario-based, in that specific setup, in that specific scenario, what is the best client affinity? It's getting a bit tricky, right? I know I couldn't call it tricky because David said it's not there to trick you. No, it's true. It's not there to trick you. If you know your technology, it's very easy to know this is the specific setting for that specific scenario. Remember, I call this the advanced. And besides the advanced, you still have the way forward to MCSE. So think about that one as well. Anyone considering MCSE? Yeah, of course you all are. Thank you. Next thing, network load balancing. Port configuration. So port configuration is, by default, if you configure network load balancing, it's active for the full range of ports. So from port 0 all the way up to 65,000 something. You have the option to configure network load balancing only for specific IP ports. For example, if you're creating a load balancing cluster only for a web server that's running HTTP and HTTPS, it might be more efficient to specifically configure that port. If any other traffic is passing by on the cable, NLB is not detecting that. So again, think about scenario-based, the best solution. That's the way the questions are formed. Cluster operation mode, unicast, multicast, and IGMP, multicast, and how to upgrade your NLB cluster. So it's more into the how to migrate, how to upgrade your NLB cluster. So that's the first part. Second part, failover clustering, is more into the real cluster configuration. So not anymore about NLB, installing a cluster. Probably, and I'm from Belgium, so my typical organization is anything between 500 users and, let's say, on average, 20 servers. And then the larger environments for still a Belgian environment, so I'm not talking about an international organization having an office in Belgium, it's close to 10,000 users and close to 100 servers. But even in the smaller environments, I mean, what we in Belgium consider as a large environment is just an SMB for you in the US, but in the end, clustering is very important. And I know clustering and mainly about the applications you install on top of the server, they all have different features for guaranteeing the high availability. Like, I know when I was doing Exchange back at the time, installing an Exchange 2000 cluster was really, really difficult. Nowadays, installing Exchange 2013, database availability groups, you don't need to know anything about clustering anymore. It's all running automatically in background. That's the easy part. What happens if something goes wrong? If you don't know how the clustering by itself from a Windows perspective is working, you're screwed anyway. So that's again why you need to know these topics. Again, MCSE is on the, well, Exchange is in the MCSE level, so that's again why Microsoft is forcing everybody who's achieving MCSE on Exchange, for example, needs to know the baseline of the server operating system. If you don't know Active Directory, if you don't know DNS, your Exchange won't work anyway. And the same goes to Link and SharePoint and all the other great pieces of software. So two main topics in the failover clustering is quorum settings and cluster networking. And again, specifically for the ones who are familiar with even NT4 2000, it looks a lot easier to configure, but in the end it's not. So you have to know the in and out. How can you test, how can you play with clustering? Maybe some of you don't have all the cool advanced hardware, probably not even at home. You have a lot of online content as well. You know TechNet Virtual Labs? Mm-hmm. Even here at TechNet, the Hands-On Labs corner, down at the expo hall to the right, I think. Hands-On Labs, you got all technologies there. For the server, I think they published like 12 labs or something. Valid for the 410, 411, 412. The labs you have over there aren't focused at all on taking the exam. It's really about getting the hands-on experience. But wasn't that what you needed for passing the exam? So it might be interesting to just plan a couple of hours doing testing in the hands-on lab as well. And you got virtual environments over there where you can play, and you can even, I wouldn't call it destroy the environment, but it's just shutting down the machines, shutting down your sessions, restarting, and it's up and running again. It's a lot easier than playing at home or playing with your production environment in the office, right? So failover clustering, very important aspect as well is storage. You have to know the difference between what kind of disks. Basic disk, dynamic disks, cluster shared volume, storage pools, thin, thick provisioned. I mean, you're familiar with that already out of the 410 and 411. And again, interaction with PowerShell, get cluster information, set cluster information. That might already be some kind of tip and trick. Again, PowerShell is important. So if you have the scenario, you need to configure this, then it's always set or new or something like that in PowerShell language. If it's like read out the configuration, it's a get command that you have to use. And again, this might sound a bit stupid and silly, but I had students giving me feedback, again, by Twitter or sending me an email like, you know what, I failed the exam. And actually, I know why I failed. I wasn't paying attention to the question. Because question four was, can you give me the commandlet, so you make the multiple selection, can you give me the command set for doing this? And then four questions later on, it's exactly the same scenario, but it's reading out information. And you think like, I already got this question, so that's easy. It's again answer B. And it had to be answer D at that time. And then you fail. So it's all about paying attention. Last thing about clustering, cluster-aware updating, CUA. New feature in 2012. Anyone already playing with that one? Happy with it? Cool. I think this is one of the coolest things in the cluster part. There are a lot of other cool stuff in server, but and not only cool, like it's just cool to use, but it's actually solving a lot of problems. One of the reasons why I shifted from doing consulting to training, any idea why? It's not that I don't like the technology anymore, but I get like a normal life again. Giving training is somewhere between 8:30 and 5. But doing consulting, it's like starting at 7 o'clock in the morning and hoping that some way your day ends at 9 o'clock in the evening. But having a wife and two kids, training is way, way better. So if you have any questions on how can I become an MCT, I mean, I can help you with that one as well. So cluster layer updating actually solves a lot of issues. If you had a cluster and you did a service pack upgrade, for example, it's always like the cluster components need to be at the same level. But how does it work if you're updating one node of the cluster and the other one is not updated yet? And then when you're doing the update and something goes wrong between the update, or when you're saying like, okay, node one is updated, so I can now update node two. And then somewhere in between something goes wrong, like power outage, for example. Then the node comes back up and it says, this is like an older version, so I'm not considering node one as a valid node in my cluster. And then you don't have a cluster anymore. Well, you still have a cluster, but it's not operational. So cluster-aware updating is solving that issue. So make sure you know a couple of things about that one. Failover clustering roles, again, very important. Interaction with PowerShell. And again, you might have a question where they, for example, show you a screenshot of the GUI cluster configuration, and you have to pinpoint a specific array, like, hey, where can you configure that specific cluster setting? Any questions so far? Going good? Too slow? Too speedy? My English is understandable? Okay. Yeah, that's the downside of being a Belgian. It's like beer and chocolate, and I like beer more than chocolate, so. Sorry? The slide deck, will it be available? Yes. If you really, really need it urgently, I can give you a copy if you have a USB stick, so I can. Yeah, you don't have to take all the pictures. I'm not really sure about the timings, exact timings when they make it available, but it could already be still this week. But if you really want to take the exam and want to take your own time to just go to the slide deck again, let me know. I'll be here for another 15 minutes because I also want to go to the party, of course.
Where are they going to be available?
Where?
Yeah,
what's
the website?
On the TechNet website. Or even on Channel 9, I think, is the main source. But there are probably some kind of redirection. So if you log on to the TechNet website again, they probably have some kind of redirect for all the sessions. Or you go to the Channel 9 directly, and you normally find them over there. Yeah. Yeah, true. Well, there's a lot of information available out there. Even the content I'm talking about here, and the some site information, it's all available on the website. So when we have some time left, I'll show you the website where you can find the specific information, the specific topics you need to know when taking the exam. Virtual machine movement, very important. I think you can all imagine Hyper-V is quite important for Microsoft. It's a very cool technology. It's working very reliable, way better than 2008. I'm not sure if that was really allowed to say, but it's even better than 2008, let's put it like that. So a couple of things around virtual machine movement. Again, think about the 410, the 411. It's more about how to install Hyper-V server role, how to configure quick migration, how to configure Hyper-V replica, things like that. This is more like, what scenario do I need to use for that specific scenario? There's a slight difference between live migration and quick migration, which might be very important on that specific scenario question on the exam. So that's very important you know that. One of the key things, quick migration, hooray, hooray, moving multiple machines. That's the main difference between quick migration and live migration. So if you have the scenario like you're the system admin of an environment with 50 VMs, and you want to make sure that you can move 16 VMs from host 1 to host 3, what is the best solution? Make sure you got the right one. Storage migration, another cool feature, another cool part. It's not about moving the VMs, it's about moving the VMs, but on a storage level. It's also very important to know. And again, this is probably something you cannot really play with at home. I don't have a cluster at home. I don't have shared storage at home. But I got my TechNet virtual labs online, so I can play there and get my hands-on experience. And again, some PowerShell possibilities as well. Import, export, and copy virtual machines. So it's, I have a configuration, I have my running VMs, and I want to migrate between hosts. What's the best way to achieve it? Importing, exporting, knowing that. For the import, you have to specify some settings. For the export, you don't have to put any settings in there. So again, if you see on the exam, of course, first of all, know the difference between import and export. But if you, for example, see four lines of PowerShell commandlets, and there is one talking about export and having a couple of options there, one of the things that they probably try to do is, you know, import, you're going to try import PowerShell commandlet, and you know, I have to specify a couple of options. And then they ask you, yeah, and what about export? And then you think, you know, in my lab at home, I just tried import, so it's probably just export, VM, blah, 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 blah. And then all the additional options aren't actually available when you do the export. And then again, it's wrong. And that's what I mean by having the hands-on experience. If you try it in your lab, at home, maybe on an online platform system, sorry, whatever, make sure that you play with the technology. And this might become a bit boring, like, hey, you have to know the technology and you have to play with it. I mean, you have to play with it. Very, very important. Reading the book, anyone wants a book? No? Well, you roll too slow. Well, we got like 30 minutes left, so plenty of books. No, it's very, very important that you play with the technology. I cannot repeat it again and again and over, probably going to mention it again and again the next couple of minutes, but it's very important. Reading in the book how cool the feature works isn't enough anymore. Maybe it's good if you're like a pre-sales consultant and you just have to know something about the technology. So if you go over to your customer like, you know, why you should migrate or upgrade from 2008 to 2012? Yeah, because you got these and these and these features. And that's the end of your story. But if you're not a pre-sales guy, but actually the engineer or the system admin in your environment, where your finance manager comes down together with the IT manager and saying like, hey, you know what? We found a budget for installing a Hyper-V cluster. And can you actually configure it for us? And you're like, I'm not sure. You know, that's so you have to make sure that you know the technology. Anyone had a question? I think it's raised right now. Last part, difference between P2V, V2V, and V2VV. Anyone knows V2VV? I'm not really sure if that's an official term, but I know that students in classroom always laugh at it, but it's V2VV? No? So you can do a V2V, it's move, I know. It's virtual to virtual, but it's V2VV. I don't know, it's not an official term, it's my joke at the end of the week normally. It's moving from the virtual, some virtual vendor to another virtual vendor. Ah. Yeah, that's it. You're still awake? Thanks for that. Very important in the V2VV is removing the VM tools. Otherwise, it won't work. You might have some issues after the move as well. So, very important. And again, you can imagine a question like, this is the scenario, you have a VMware platform, we have System Center in between, and we want to perform a V2V. What is the first thing you need to do? And then you see like, yeah, you have to make sure that the clustering is available, that your, I don't know, system center is up and running and stuff. And then you see like, hey, I have to remove the VM tools. Ah, yeah, I remember from the TechEd session. So it's like removing the specific VMware drivers out of the machine, doing the move, and then it's taking over the Hyper-V drivers anyway. So otherwise, you might get some conflicts. Yes?
How do you get that knowledge?
Sorry.
How much VMM knowledge?
Actually, not that much. This might sound a bit strange, but there's another course, another exam on private cloud, which is really, really in-depth on virtual machine manager. Does it mean you won't get any questions on VMM in this exam? There will be questions, but not on the same in-depth level as the private cloud one. From a real-world perspective, sorry, make sure you install VMM at least once, and you play around with the interface. Maybe learn some PowerShell commandlets as well, but not into the real in-depth level you need for the private cloud exams. But you will get questions on VMM. Again, ClusterAware updating, but we talked about that one already, so I can probably skip this one. Another thing, scale-out file servers. Anyone familiar already with scale-out file servers? Mm-hmm. Very important, scale-out file servers. We're always thinking about, yeah, so it's interesting for my file shares, but it's actually not usable for file shares. But again, the question, the Microsoft exam question, was not to trick you, so it's just like some kind of tip and trick again. So the scale-out file servers is more using my SMB platform for full performant environments, like SQL, for example, 2012 and 2014 as well. It supports SMB as a baseline for configuring your databases on storage level. And then you can scale out by using the scale out file server feature. Very cool. But again, one of the important things is it's not usable for file shares, although it's a file server feature. VMM movement, I'm going to give you some time to read the gotcha, because that's like the most important message. Got it? Again, think of it as scenario-based question, like you're running Hyper-V 2008 on that specific processor machine, and you buy new servers and you need to move the VMs without doing any upgrades whatsoever, and you're moving from processor type A to processor type B, think about the gotcha. So the first practical question. Going to give you a few minutes. You know who this fellow is? A fuzzy head, yeah. No? Well, this is Mr. Transcender. He's actually the sponsor for this kind of questions. No, Mr. Transcender. So this is the second level, right? So on the third floor, we do have the study hall, well, what we as MCT ambassadors call the study hall. It's actually a quiet room that's, first of all, very important, where you can actually try test exams. And the test exams are sponsored by Mr. Transcender. So if you walk up over there, besides getting this cool fellow here, you can take free tests where you can make yourself familiar with how does a question look like. So all the questions, and I got a few of those, the next couple of slides. All the questions here, there's no reason for taking a picture of the question and hoping that this question will be in your life exam. It won't. But maybe in a slight different format it will be. So in the meantime, you had time enough to read the question. So we're going to do a little game here. You can win Mr. Trendsender. A, B, C, or D. So by a show of hands, who says A? And again, if you fail, don't worry. Not that many hands. Cool. Who says B? A bit more. C. Mm-hmm. And D. So we got like a good mix, actually. In most questions, it's like A, and then 95% of the room goes, yep. And then the other 5% is like, yeah, probably wasn't paying attention anymore. So this is like a good mix. I think most of you said B. So that's the right answer. I don't know anyone anymore who was in A or B, so I'm just going to throw it out. Make sure that you pick it up. So if you take the exam, make sure that you put it on front of your monitor. So, first topic is finished. Going to make sure that we can speed up a bit, because otherwise I'm losing out of time and then you're missing the beers. File and storage solutions. Advanced file services, dynamic access control, and optimizing your storage as the main topics. Advanced file services, very important feature, NFS. Why important NFS? Integration with VMware. I don't know anything about VMware, but somehow I know that NFS and VMware is like very, very important. So if you're migrating away from VMware to Hyper-V, or maybe creating like, I'm not really sure if you can call it a hybrid environment, because hybrid, and you're mainly talking about on-premise and cloud, but let's say hybrid in Hyper-V and VMware, maybe somewhere in between NFS is also very important. So make sure that you know the in and out of NFS. And branch cache, nothing really new compared to 2008. So if you're familiar with branch cache in 2008, you probably know more than enough on that level. Talking about the exam, of course. Advanced file services, file classification. What's the key thing about file classification is you have your file shares, and you want to make sure that you can control the data by, for example, specifying if that specific document is being created by my sales guy and it's stored on the sales share. I want to make sure that the document gets a classification of confidential, and only salespeople can use that document. So it's an advanced feature set of the file services. And maybe already very important for a lot of organizations, you have file access auditing as well. Who is actually getting access to files? So it's not only talking about who has the security rights by using NTFS, read, write, full control, whatever settings you define on your share, but it also allows you to get some kind of reporting. Who is using my file system? So one of the questions you might have on the exam is, this is the scenario, you're the system admin of the environment, and you want to find out who is getting access to that specific file share. File classification might be the correct answer. Dynamic access control, another new feature in 2012. Dynamic access control is what I like to call NTFS 2.0, but I'm not really sure if they numbered NTFS, so if they did, it's probably NTFS 9.0 something. Think about dynamic access control as not only having NTFS security, but having like a dynamic way of getting control to my files. You have to be part of the sales security group on Active Directory level, and you have to connect from a domain joined client. And then you have full control to the files. If, however, you're still part of the Active Directory security group, but you're connecting outside of my network by using a tablet who's not domain joined, then I give you read-only access to the files. That's the purpose of dynamic access control.
What
I think 2012. Maybe 2008 or 2, but I don't think so. I think it's quite new in 12. Mm-hmm. Very cool feature from a real-world perspective, very complex to configure from a business perspective. It isn't that hard from a technical perspective, but it's like throwing away all your knowledge about NTFS security and starting from scratch. And then you go over to the business like, any sales guy can get access to your data? Yeah, because they are part of the Active Directory sales security group. Any idea what they are doing with your files? No, not really. Are you worried about it? Actually, yes, I am. That's the key message for using dynamic access control. If you have read-write access to a share, you can do whatever you want with the files. By using dynamic access control, you still have access, but you cannot do whatever you want with the files. Very important. Couple of information, but again, the slide deck will be available, and it's way too much information anyway on the slide deck. But very important is user and device claim types. So claim types, without going too much in detail, it's like an advanced authentication authorization mechanism. So it's not only having an Active Directory username and password, and it exists on device level and on user level. So maybe you can access the files if you're that specific user because you're a domain joined user, but maybe it's not working because you're not running it on a device having the authority claim installed on the device. So that's what I meant by my example, the difference between a mobile device and a domain joined desktop, for example. And again, PowerShell shouldn't be a surprise. iSCSI targeting and initiator, again, no real feature, new feature in 2012. It already exists since, I don't know, probably Windows 2000, pretty sure about 2003. It's actually still the same. But configuration out of the wizard, and again, by using PowerShell, we didn't exist in 2003 yet. So. Thin provisioning, trim provisioning, making your disk smaller. Wasn't possible before, now it is. Well, it was before, but not out of the box. You need some additional tools for that. And then the last one is also interesting. Uninstall Windows feature to reclaim some space. Instead of taking away 16 gigs when you install Windows, it's like only taking 8 or something, I don't know. And again, a question. A, B, C, or D? Anyone wants to shout out? Okay, who was the first one? Making it a bit easier for me. Yeah, you were the first one. And you said?
B.
B? It's B. You got yourself a book? You don't need a book. For the ones who are a bit disappointed, from our friends from Microsoft Press, I'm going to make sure I finish my session in time. I got 20 vouchers. It's not a guarantee you have the book. What's the catch? They only have 1,200 available. Not only this one, so they got 1,200 books in total. But they only started at noon. So if you're, after the session, quickly going down to the expo hall, go over to the MS Press. There's a small corner next to the certification booth we have there. Just show them this flyer. Tell them I gave it to you in my session. And if you're in between the 1,200, you get a free copy of the book as well. Not paper, it's an ebook, but it's still the same. It's about the content. So answer B was the correct one. Business continuity, disaster recovery, backups, backup and recovery, recovering servers, and site fault tolerance. Windows Server Backup, how to install the feature, how to control it, and how to configure, as I already mentioned in the beginning, the online backups. I don't have to tell you that you probably will see a question on online backups. Why would that be? Maybe because Azure is quite important. And managing backups, again, by using the VSS admin command line, but this is the same since 2008. So if you're familiar with 2008 VSS admin, it's actually still the same. Site-level fault tolerance, the main thing about stretch clusters, site failover, the key feature of Windows Server is Hyper-V replica. I assume my colleague talked about Hyper-V replica in the previous versions, sessions, so I'm not really going to dive into that too much. But when you see the scenario, like you have an office in Houston and an office in Barcelona, and you want to make sure that your VMs are high available between the two sites, Hyper-V replica is like the one possible feature. Without other features, when you have like the cool, fancy, way too expensive storage and stuff, but just out of the Windows Server topics, Hyper-V is like the only answer when you're talking about multi-site VM environments. And again, Azure Online Backups, talked about that one. Sorry. Again, a question, an easy one, I think. So you all say together, hey, really. Networking services, DHCP DNS, you know, out of the 4.10, 4.11 session, very important addition in the 4.12 IPAM. IPAM is IP address management. By lack of time, I can't really go into too much detail about IPAM. DHCP, it's just DHCP. So again, think about when you're studying for the 4.10 about DHCP, everything you learn for the 4.10, you have to learn again for the 4.12. So that's easy. So I can skip a couple of things. DNS, I assume you've probably seen the same slides. And then we are talking about IPAM. IPAM is, for larger environments, one of the most interesting features when talking about DHCP DNS management. It's like an overall management solution for DNS and DHCP and fixed IP addresses, if you want. So when a software company comes into your organization and they want to install a CRM, the technical guy comes over and says, you know, I need 5 IP addresses. And then you go over to your PC and then you fire up an Excel file and then you start looking for a fixed IP address, right? That's the way how you control IP addresses. No? I do. No. I'm using IPAM for that. So what is IPAM? It's like a layer on top of the DNS, DHCP, that allows you to do management of your IP infrastructure for a single server, multiple sites, it doesn't matter. When you do configuration within IPAM, it's actually injecting the configuration in the DNS services. In the DHCP services. So it's not like replacing the DNS consoles, it's not replacing DHCP, but it's a management solution on top of it. A couple of things very important without again going too much in detail. You cannot install IPAM on a domain controller. You cannot install it on a DNS and DHCP box. It's a management solution. So think about that when you see the scenario. You've got like 5 servers, server A, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Server 1 is a domain controller. Server 2 is a DNS server. Server 3 is DHCP. On which server will you install IPAM? It's not 1 or 2 or 3. Yeah, something like that. Or pick the best one or something. I don't know. So very important. And of course, quite logic, the IPAM server needs to be part of the domain. Why? Because the interaction between IPAM and the DNS and DHCP services is triggered out of Active Directory, of course. It's all secured, so very important. And again, a question? Gives me some time to check on timing, like 10 minutes left. I'm not going to ask you to shout it out loud. So you could, for example, what I mentioned before, so imagine the scenario they give you and they specify you're still running server 2012, then you know that on database level it's a bit different, talking about IBAN. But normally I assume, I mean, we're again a few weeks further down the road, I think most content will be R2 only. That's my opinion. I'm just going to show it because show of hands is a bit difficult if you have multiple. Now, why is this question important? Not from a technical level. It's the question, what should you do? Choose all that apply. Why is that important? It's all or nothing. Sometimes you got a question like, yeah, you know, I got four answers and I missed one of them. So do I get like 75% of the scoring? No. It's a wrong answer, so you don't get any points at that time. So also very important, choose all that apply. Sometimes they explicitly mention, give me two options. Yep. Yep. Yeah, that could be, yeah. Like, the longest multiple choice question I had was 12 options. And then only one of them was right. And that's really a hard one. I mean, you can think like, you know, multiple choice, four bullets, yeah. Two of them are always wrong. And then it's like one or three, bam, bam, one. And then just hoping it's correct. But if you got a list like 12 options, I mean, marking the two that are definitely wrong, yeah, okay, but then you still got 10 left. Then it's really hard to go like, yeah, 1 and 10 and 7 and. Yeah, question.
What advice do you have for questions that will give you very little context and will say, you need to accomplish this goal, whether it's something regarding the verification, there may be four tools, two or three of which all do the same option. So how are you to determine which one is the right?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the thing is, if, let's say you got multiple choice and you got four options and three of them are like going into the right direction. One of the keywords you could find is, what is the best solution or the quickest solution or the one requiring least administration? I really love that one. Least administration is always PowerShell. Always PowerShell. So imagine they ask you to, I don't know, configure the HTTP, install the feature. And they show you, okay, option one is you go into the server manager tools and then add server rules and features. Second answer is by using PowerShell. And the third one is, I don't know, any other way how you can install it, doesn't matter. You know that when they ask you like least administration, it's always PowerShell. Active Directory, quickly going through this one because Active Directory is like a retake from the 4.10 and partly from the 4.11. Because otherwise I'm really running out of time. Trusts are still there and actually still working. I found this one out last week when I was at a customer myself. They had a 2003, so not the R2, 2003 environment running. And they want to move to 2012 R2. And I tried to configure a trust, and it actually worked. But not completely. But this is not really relevant for the exam, but I just want to share the story. So when you configure a trust, you can decide between a one-way and a two-way. So I just was on my 2012 R2 box, and I configured a two-way trust. Why the two-way? Because it's super easy to configure. And by using the wizard, you know that it's working or it's not working. So do next finish. The wizard was working. Everything was up and running. So I logged back onto my 2003 server, going to the domains and trusts, and hey, my trust information is there. So I was like, hey, cool, the trust is working. But for some reason, it wasn't. Now, what was the issue? By using the wizard, it's creating a stub zone in DNS. For some reason, I don't know why, I'm going to talk with some colleagues over in the Ask the Experts, but for some reason, the stub zone was created, but it wasn't functional. So I removed the stub zone. I recreated the stub zone manually in probably the same way as the wizard, and that was working. But I'm not sure if it's like a bug or maybe I did something wrong or maybe a difference between the 2003 version and 12 R2, I'm not sure. But just know from a technical level, you can create a trust between a 2003 and an R2, which is like 15 years in between. Well, no, not 15, 10 years in between. So probably a cool information if you're doing migrations. So knowing the trust is still very important. Active Directory sysfol, you learn about that one in the 10 and 11. I'm going to skip some stuff because otherwise we're really running out of time. Identity access solutions, ADFS, certificate services, and digital rights management. ADFS, it's all about PowerShell. That's the best way to configure ADFS. So just remember the commandlets. Certificate services, I haven't really dived in too much detail myself on certificate services, but from what I know myself out of my experience, it's all the same as in 2008, and up to a certain level the same as in 2003. So if you're familiar with installing a certificate server in 2003, 2008, it's the same way in 2012. Configuring auto-enrollment, configuring the web enrollment feature, where you go up to your website server / cert-srv. It's all operational, it's functional, and it's all the same. Might be some little differences, but I don't know them by heart either. So, cert-util, command line tool for playing with your certificates. Also quite important. And then managing, playing with the templates, certificate enrollment, knowing where to find it in the GPO settings. This might be like a question where they show you a screenshot of the GPO settings, making multiple circles in different areas of the screenshot, and then they ask you, can you pinpoint the exact location? And again, if you just read about it, you probably won't remember because you think like, yeah, I'm familiar with the window and not really paying attention too much. Where if you play with the technology and you really configure the certificates, and then you'll find out, okay, I have to go to here and here and then configure the policy. So that's quite important. Digital rights management, so making sure that you can secure your files, that they are not or not walking out of your environment, or if they are walking out of your environment, that nobody can misuse them. That's digital rights management. This might be a bit hard on the exam because not that many customers are already using it. I think for the last 4 years, 2008, it's not a new feature in 12, it's already existed in 2008. I think I installed it like 4 times. It's very useful in an organization. But I don't know why, but people aren't really paying attention to what's actually happening with my data. Didn't know what happened with the sound system either, but probably because the door was flying open, I don't know. Last piece of advice. Is this like guessing or is that wrong? I don't know. Never guess at the exam. Never. You have to make sure that you know what you're talking about. So with that, 2 call to actions. The first one is If you walk out the session, you think like, you know, I know everything the guy was talking about. Walk out and book the exam. I'm not sure if it's still open to make the reservation. If not, tomorrow morning, when TechEd opens, make sure that you're there and book your exam. Second call to action, it's something a bit more personal. I've been standing here beside this, but I'll walk over here. Maybe it's not really clear, but I'm wearing yellow pants. Seems to be really strange that someone is wearing yellow pants. What actually is the idea behind the yellow pants? So last year with one of my fellow MCT ambassadors at TechEd Madrid, we were doing our thing. And then someone noticed like, hey, you're both wearing yellow pants. And it was really true by coincidence. So we found it quite funny to play with it. And we started the TechEd Yellow Pants team. So one of the things we are doing out of the team is doing a lot of evangelism around certification. In Belgium, the other guys from the Netherlands, so we are traveling around Europe and the US talking about certification. Why do people need to get certified? And not only at conferences, but a few weeks ago I was at a company in Germany, a Microsoft IT partner having 500 consultants, and he was not convinced that he need to pay invest in his people for making sure they got certified. And I was there out of the MCT community. And they were like, yeah, can you maybe do a talk to my technical team, convince them, and not really like, I'm the boss and I have forced you to take an exam, but out of my experience being a trainer and still doing consulting as well, how being certified actually can change your life. So that's also one of the things trying to achieve. The cool thing about the TechEd Yellow Pants for you is we do a contest every day during TechEd. The website is live like, I think, 2 hours ago or something. So we still have to invest a small contest for today. But the rest of the week we'll fire up tips and tricks for the exams, where to find the information besides just attending the exam preps, of course. But the main thing is we love TechEd, we love the parties, we love certification. So if these three things are of your interest, make sure that you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, whatever. You find all the information on the website. Last 2 minutes, specifically for TechEd, where can you find the information? First of all, attending breakout sessions. So let's say you're familiar with all the topics I talked about besides IPAM. I'm pretty sure there's IPAM content in the sessions. So maybe by attending one of those sessions, 1 hour and 15 minutes, you learn enough to know your stuff about IPAM, and of course all the other topics. Hands-on labs, I can't say it enough, you need to play with the technology. Hands-on means you play with the technology. So we got like 300 machines over there, they're available all day long, we got MCTs walking around. If you have a technical question, something is not working, or just having a question about the technology, my co-workers are walking there. They are there for helping you. If you have a question like, yeah, you know, I've been playing with this cluster configuration and I can follow the lab guide, like do step one, do step two, do step three, and it's working, but I'm actually don't understand what I'm doing, raise your hand, a cluster expert will come over to help you. That's the idea about hands-on labs. The study hall, again, third floor, where you can try the free exams from Mr. Transcender. Sounds like marketing, way too much. For the free ones, I think you can just walk in if there are still seats available. And then the last piece of information is the Microsoft website. The main landing website is Microsoft.com/learning. And then it's like tiles based almost to find your information. I want to take an exam on server, on desktop, and so on. Just by clicking through, it gives you all the details. All the information I talked about during my session is actually on that website as well. Not really on technical details, a couple of things I talked about, but the main headlights, like the 6 objectives, think about the 15 and 20% slide I was talking about, that information is out there. So with that, I'd like to thank you for being here. I hope you enjoy, first of all, the drinks we have in the expo hall. It's snacks and drinks, it's pretty cool. For the ones who are already certified, and they managed their way through to have these sheriff badges, the MCP badges. There's a cool party tonight. You all knew about that one, right? Yeah, you got one. Cool. So I'll see you at the party. Very important for me and for Microsoft Learning is the evaluation. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like about the session. You're all here. Most of you were here since the beginning. I can imagine for the ones who were doing the 410, 411, 412, it's like an overload of information. Don't worry. If you feel like, I know my topic, I'm confident when I walked out of the room, keep that feeling and make sure you pass. If you take the exam, you pass, let me know. If you fail, please also let me know. If still within TechEd, I can try to help you. You can do a retake within 24 hours. So let's say tomorrow morning you take an exam, you fail, you can do a retake on Wednesday. And it's 50% off, so that's another benefit. I'm finished. Thank you.